Thank you very much. Thank you for the introduction, and thank you also for the invitation to speak about those topics, which are extremely interesting and have lots of urgency. And I'm going to start from where Mark Wigley left, because listing exclusions won't work. I couldn't agree more. And limits, obviously, borders are what I want to look at. And in a way, I will go back to point 3.2 of Erhard Schoedpelz's talk, and you will see where that is in a moment. And already yesterday evening when I was here, and Christine Khoury and Rasha Salty ended their wonderful presentation on suggesting to actually abolish the canon, and again, couldn't agree more, all for it. And to my mind, one way of doing that is to very consciously misuse it. Because if we don't just want yet another canon, we cannot simply dispute it, we have to fuck it up. And this intention has been taken to a few historical extremes already, of course, like Walter Benjamin's artwork essay, which was aiming at an art history, no word of which could be useful to fascism, or Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari's Anti-Oedipus as a defascization of the bourgeois subject. Or, in fact, art historian Peter Gorsen's attempt to reappropriate the word entartet, degenerate, because no single word can be left to them. And again, I couldn't agree more. My own attempt here today is, of course, much more modest, not only in size, but also in ambition, as the misuse I'm aiming at is simply running up against the habitualized and canonized aversion against formalism that new art history, but not only new art history, also Marxist art history, has stabilized since the 70s. And so my cherishing of formalism is not only a heartfelt attempt to restore some of the discussions that have taken place in its vein, but also, for all its merits, to fuck up new art history a bit. But I'm not going to talk about new art history here. I was looking at it, but then I thought it's not that interesting to criticize it at length. So here starts my argument, and it's a very methodological one, I'm afraid. But I'm going to let you look at a horse for a bit. So, an individually insurmountable obstacle is positioned at the very core of any consequential investment into what has become known as modern and contemporary art. And this obstacle lies in the fact that, politically speaking, culturally speaking, socially speaking, and psychologically speaking, art stages a problem. Or, to start off right away with quoting an eminent formalist, the Russian critic, theorist, and writer Viktor Shklovsky, there exists a church of art in the sense of a gathering of those who feel it. This church has its canons, created by the accumulation of heresies. Shklovsky wrote this 1 year after the Russian Revolution in 1918, underlining that collective creativity, and that's the title of the text I just quoted, was yet nothing but a heresy filling again that church of art. And what remained sadly true for most parts back then hardly even surfaces as objectionable today. Art is bound to perform inescapable dramatizations of the consequential incapacities of its forms. And that extends to both modern and contemporary art. Both their canons are not least symptomatic panoramas of those changing incapacities, of the empty centers of these congregations. My primary interest, however, lies with expanding in how far these changing incapacities of artistic form are, or might be pushed to become, politically, culturally, socially, and psychologically more consequential. And how what I would tentatively call a debordered formalism, entgrenzter Formalismus in German, might serve as a lever towards such a rematerialized understanding of artistic form. A formalism that does, in fact, conform to the central accusation against formalism in the last 100 years. It does attempt to cut off art's forms from its contents. But not only art's forms, but all forms, including our own. Because to expand also Shklovsky's change of views, art is not the only church. And while this may not have been the case in Russia in 1918, One can today say that the Church of Politics and the Church of the Subject are canonized no less by their heresies. And so my suggestion, and I go back to the horse, and so my suggestion of a drastic expansion of formalism has at least two reasons. The first reason lies in my own starting point, art, or more precisely, art history of contemporary art. The fundamental intermediality of contemporary art, and that is that art which rose with new art history, the invariable composition of its specimens from multiple media, would render a formalism that seeks out the practical organization of form in singularized, genre-specific artworks alone, both delusional and ineffective. If the functional analysis of forms of art within a state of intermediality is not processed with the reappearances of the very same forms in other functional contexts, in as well as outside of art, their social normalization is not interrupted, but just momentarily obliterated. And the second reason lies in contemporary life, that is arguably life within catastrophic financialization. Because what is stipulated to be an artwork by social and economic convention today may, in fact, formalistically not really serve the modern implications of that concept, but rather present itself as a collocation of functional principles of organization which are borrowed from other fields. And don't get me wrong, I mean that in the most positive sense. If you think again of what Christine and Russia presented yesterday, for example, what they presented as the Salon de la Jeune Peinture, and what is expanded in the exhibition here, you find art posing not least in the forms of politics, and that in the best cases renders both the form of art and that of politics drastically challenged in their conversion. Or if you think of Anselm's example of yesterday's introduction of the Guggenheim Abu Dhabi, this is a place that is identifiable in its forms as a museum, only from a very narrow angle. So this state of intermediality might apply not only to art. The assumption, for example, of humans being subjects might, formalistically reviewed from today, not live up to its presupposed modern standards either. And neither does the political seem to gather its forms from those ideals of emancipation that led to the global north to worship the modern nation state for more than 200 years now. So what I'm reaching for with such a deboarded formalism is basically a consequential, an actualized practice of alienation, an actual refusal to reproduce, if you will, a state of systemic denial. The formalist strategy of defamiliarization introduced in Shklovsky's seminal essay, Art as Technique, or also translated as Art as Device, which I prefer, of 1916, defined art, or more specifically literature and poetic language, as a distinct sphere in which an estrangement effect, as Brecht later called it, could take place. In his essay, Shklovsky exemplifies this using Tolstoy's Kolstomor, the story of a horse. This is the horse. And this is the horse in a series of postcards which the socialist realist Arkady Alexandrovich Plastov drew for different publications of that book. Tolstoy wrote the story in the 1860s, but published it only in 1886. And it's written from the viewpoint of Kolstomer, the viewpoint of the horse, who in narrating his life characterizes human behavior, but not by what it socially represents, but by what it effectuates. The horse's main point of concern with human behavior lies in the forms of property. The horse marvels why the word mine seems so endemic to human language, when mine seems to serve not as an attribute of proximity, but rather as one of distance. The people who called the horse mine were never the ones feeding it, washing it, or riding it. So we're talking about a kind of proto-materialist horse. Because this obviously is a figure that Karl Marx, around the same time, has also described in Capital, Volume 1, as a problem of form. Property is the form that defines all social relations under capital. And what it creates, what Marx called the doubly free wage laborer, is a person who does not owe his means of production and so has to lend the only thing he owes, his labor power, to someone else so that that person, the capitalist, can use it on the machines that he owes. So, the defamiliarization Sklovsky makes out in Tolstoy is a formal literary device that consciously misuses and appropriates formally what socially characterizes modern forms of alienation under capitalism. Formalism suggests too, rather than naturalize alienation, to defamiliarize the life that it effectuates. And this has one central effect that recurs in all formalism, and that is that the normalized temporal order of modern industrial life is interrupted and reshuffled. Unduly using the words of Roland Barthes' famous quote from Myth Today of 1957, one could say, a little formalism turns one away from history, but a lot brings one back to it. And this is why Lou Merton, the Berlin-based self-taught philosopher, art historian, ethnologist, economist, poet, and immensely productive feminist writer, appears in the abstract to my talk. Because even though she was by no means a formalist, but an avid advocate of the prolet cult, to which I'll return in a bit, she developed a notion of form through which she tried to reconfigure not only an understanding of the different arts, but in their radical debordering, reconfigure our notion of history altogether. In her only book-length theoretical publication, because she also wrote novels, Wesen und Veränderung der Formen / Künste, Essence and Variations of Forms and Arts, published in 1924, Merton proposes something like a materialist ontology of form. In her perspective, form comes first. And so the church Sklovsky is speaking of is for Merton but one side of its concentration. Her art history is a history of social form, not of style, a history besides art. Merton's understanding of the arts is not debordering, it is debordered. And this is why, for me, she serves as a central figure of orientation of a debordered formalism, because, for one, her work is something which today seems almost unthinkable. It is anti-disciplinary. It's not trans-inter-something disciplinary, it's anti-disciplinary. Where formalism has not least been pivotal in establishing the scientific dignity of literature studies, semiotics, as well as art history, with Wölfflin and Riegel, Merton willfully uses form in a contrary sense. Concentrations of form here serve to consequentially demolish the forms of social control, of capitalist socialization, of alienation by way of property. Merton's is, if you will, a formal ontology of expropriation, in her own words, for all mechanical labor. Recovery of the lost content via leisure, via the application of the machine for the quality, for the collective means. The importance of the means can only be decided by their ends. Therefore, it is more than possible that a mass does not require the so-called arts. To demonstrate that, Merton cuts across time. Antiquity, Middle Ages, feudalism, industrialization, it's all there. Establishing that there is no art in an absolute sense. It, the concept of form, only began to apply to the consciousness of art as an abstract faculty when the proliferation of a general being of form had died. This is when capitalism began and redefined the world as a property relation. So, with the consequential denaturalization of modern temporal order, also property relations, the very basis of social alienations, are brought into flux. Again, this can be tracked also when going back to Russian formalism. And while also Merton wrote not only about form as an epistemic ontology through the ages, but also was deeply invested in tracking down those very possibilities within the arts of her time, writing, as I said already, on the prolet cult, but also on Dada and Bauhaus, It was also in Russian formalism, not only the then recent literary history like Tolstoy, that led to its formation in the early 10s, but also more embodied contemporaneous artistic practices of defamiliarization, like those of Russian futurism, of writers like Velimir Khlebnikov, who in his Zaun poetry denaturalized widely differentiated forms of prosaic and poetic language alike, not least by disharmonizing the temporal and social orders they figured in at the time. The folklorism, the fairy tales, and religious chants, which here were realigned towards the future, were, like the form which Merton aims to carve out of history, of no property, but of much use, as they demarcated a non-aligned temporality. Shklovsky, for example, wrote in Futurism's Defense already in 1915 in his text Premises of Futurism, where he argued that forms can actually die out socially and that the futurist method of bringing back presumably dead forms changes drastically the lives they are planted into. He here sees, and I quote again, a language that is, so to speak, personal, with words having no definite meaning but affecting the emotions directly. And thus, estrangement, a practice of alienating the present by speaking of the future in tongues of the past, here serves as a socially consequential formalism from art. And this notion of form as condensed feeling that can be formed in art to be debordered from it is what drives Merton, even in her discussion of the Russian prolet cult in 1918, where she asks, what has become of art in the capitalist century? A special function, a commodity, a thing that exists somewhere outside of everyday life, a thing with the nimbus of particularly exquisite life, secrets. But it is the secrets of all living humans, provided they could finally awaken from the dead, provided they want to discover the miracle of their lives. So even though the theoretical debates around Russian formalism that were driven by the incentive of people like Shklovsky, but also Ose Brick, who was also part of prolet cult, or Roman Jakobson, were focused on literature and linguism, they were already at the time lots of discussants who either aimed to extend formalism into other fields of art and life, as did Russian productivist and prolet cult secretary Boris Arvatov, or proposed to rebuild our understanding of art from the changes in living forms, like Lou Merton, who entered into the question of form just like Arvatov from a more socially oriented theory of the arts. They, however, did not relegate form to a mere effect of sociality, but quite on the contrary, and this relegating form to a mere effect of sociality is obviously the problem with lots of Marxist art history, which they too discuss at the time, that like we need a more radical Marxist art history. But they quite on the contrary proposed a strategic primacy of form or a formalism in any attempt to antagonize, to revolutionize the present tense. To put it in the words of Arvatov in his 1928 correction of Shklovsky's above quoted text, Art as Device, the task of scientific poetics lies in understanding what Shklovsky called the contrariety of poetic language itself as a specific form of practical organization. Where Shklovsky and also Jakobson insisted on the fundamental difference between poetic language and practical language, and thus artistic form and lived form, Arvatov and Merton would agree, but would at the same time argue that this does not relieve formalism from exploring both, if it does not simply want to stabilize the hierarchical order. And this is why I'm interested less in formalism's later broadening into structuralism, which one can go through, obviously, through Jakobson and then Levi-Strauss, and which in this context would be really interesting, but quite honestly, it's also really far beyond what I could actually do. So what I'm interested in, for starters, is returning to different formalisms as historical dramatizations of not only of artistic estrangement, but of alienation as a social practice proper. because while Shklovsky, Merten, and Arbatov, all for a brief moment after 1918, hoped that alienation would end and estrangement would turn into a structural cultural technique rather than in lived capitalist form, we are far beyond that hope today. So there might be a rather contemporary urge to dramatize formalist estrangement in its relation to capitalist alienation. And this is, and I'm moving towards the end and jumping into the present now, and this is why I, again, returning to proposing a formalism that extends to all that seems familiar, also to Marxism, because it might actually be familiar no more if we look at it from this side of things. While art, as much as the political, are still juridically and economically based on the modern terms of the global north, in which art serves as a sphere of dramatization, a form that mildly reverberates in the political, the cultural, the social, and the psychological, it seems fair to ask, why stabilize that relationship in taking its inherited modern forms, which are all based on the notion of property, and thus on the terms of systemic alienation, for granted? In 1989, French philosopher Philippe Lacoulabard, in a discussion at London's ICA about postmodernism, argued against Jean-François Lyotard and painfully in that pointed to what distances us from Arbatov and Merten today. He argued that while modern art had tried to escape the aesthetic and, quite frankly, to not be art any longer, postmodernity had to deal with the residues of its very failure to do so. And if you think of writings or actions of people like Craig Owens or Douglas Crimp, they did quite beautifully so. So in the process, however, art's forms were irreversibly corrupted, which I mean very positively. And today, one could add that in contemporary art, we find the return of the modern escapism. But this time around, it is arguably an escapism of art into the aesthetic and not art from the aesthetic, an aesthetic mimicry to all those contemporary forms which shape the crisis-ridden present outside of art, an aesthetic mimicry to catastrophic contemporaneity. And again, there is a hope to overcome alienation, but this time it is more in hoping that it might become total. That the disidentification of form and content that life under capitalism, life in property form, is based upon can actually be sublated, that medium specificity is over, not only in art, but also in humanity.
Can we go to that website for a second?
Basically, this is going to repeat itself forever. So, do I need to say more? There are quite a few contemporary examples of this tendency, but I find this, at this point, to be the most consequential one. Because here, use, the category that Tolstoy, Shklovsky, Merten, and Arbatov alike had contrasted to property, the category that either defied alienation or turned it into a praxis of estrangement, is no longer present. Here the category of form inscribes a post-mediatic holism of the exchange form, a holism that knows, for all its worth, no borders, no nations, and no subjects. So that's not bad, but it also knows no starvation, no brutality, and no finitude. What is presented is a pathological capitalization of all living and non-living form. Property is defined by its financialized flux, by the detemporalized moment of exchange, which, as we learned from Alfred Sohn Rethel, is the exact antinomy of use. Exchange is the moment in which use is discontinued. So, we have a mimicry to circulation, a mimicry to capital as financialized abstraction beyond any formal specificity. But the beautiful thing is... Can you turn that off? I can't, it's like I'm pathologizing myself while hearing this. But blah, 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 where was I? Sorry. But the beautiful thing is there is no boundless mimicry. There never was. And we can see that already in the discussion which Georges Bataille and Roger Calois had, where Bataille argued against Calois that mimicry is always lastly defined by its unpassable borders. And thus, we might take up formalism, proving that this is not an art of all form, but a correlation of many whose use can be retrieved, revived, and re-established. To seek out the borders of this aesthetic escapism and rematerialize it, to make it consequential, and to extrapolate the times it actually cuts across in absolutizing the exchange of the present tense. Because modern art demonstrates maybe form beyond use, while one could argue contemporary art demonstrates in the end nothing but used forms. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Kerstin. We'll continue with the moving image now, and we'll show the film The Man in the Background by Lene Berg. She herself will make her appearance after the screening. This will bring us back from that kind of present situated in the near future to the kind of foundation moment also of the architecture here, to the ideological framework of liberal humanism, the kind of frontier architecture that we are in its many connotations and explicit and implicit frameworks. And in fact, just to make one sort of practical comment, the topic that you find addressed here will probably be subject of a larger project. We've just began to compose with a group to discuss these multiple connotations of what was called the Congress für kulturelle Freiheit, the Congress for Cultural Freedom, founded in West Berlin in 1951. And you'll learn about that in this film and later in Lene Berg's presentation.
Well, the word has become terribly overused, but gosh, he was charismatic. Charismatic.
Your husband?
No. No. Well, the greatest privilege of all was of knowing him, of course.
Allt tyder på att detta är Michael Josephson och hans kone Diana. Till synelaten ett helt vanligt äktepar på ferie i Europa 1958 om hösten. De är på väg till Rhodos där de ska delta på en kongress med titeln Representative Governments and Public Liberties in the New States. Michael Josephson är arrangör och deltagarna är vänner och kollegor från stora delar av världen. Men allt är inte akkurat det det ser ut till att vara. Om 10 år kommer paret Josephson till att mista nästan allt. Deras arbetsgivare kommer till att slå handen av dem på en ganska brutal måte. Vänner och bekänte kommer till att vända sig mot dem eller försvinner helt. På kort tid kommer han till att reduceras till en förenvarande arbetslös direktör och hon må ta sig jobb som sekretär. Men de kommer till att hålla samman. Uansett hur jävligt det blir, håller de samman. Till döden skiljer dem av genom Michael Josephsons för tidig död 1978.
We lived this devil life completely, and the devil one was essentially to be kept secret, and was had threats all around it, and you never knew when one would come up. But I remember having lunch with couple of big shots, but I don't remember who, but they were big shots, and they had heard rumors, and the whole lunch was given to Michael charming them and saying no, and I would come in and have a background backup, you know, and say no.
Detta är inte bara Michael Josephson och hans kone Diana. Detta är också Jonathan F. Seiba och Jean Ensinger. En CIA-agent och hans hustru på väg till en så kallad kongress på Rhodos mitt under den kalla krigen. Officiellt är han direktör för en stor kulturorganisation med säte i Paris och filialer över stora delar av världen. The Congress for Cultural Freedom. I verkligheten är han en av hjärnorna bak en världsomspännande konspiration, senare också kallt The Liberal Conspiracy. Officiellt är målet att bekämpa totalitära idéer och regimer med hjälp av kunst, kultur och forskning. I realiteten handlar det om att vända den europeiska kultureliten bort från kommunism och socialism, och inte minst om att förbättra bilden av USA. Hvis någon spör vem som betalar för denna kongressen, för deltagarnas resor, honorarer, mat, hotell och uppehåll i 5 dagar, kommer Michael Josephson till att lyva. Och Diana kommer till att stötta honom så gott hon kan. De är svärt goda till att lyva. De lyver för vänner, för kollegor, för journalister och för alla andra som kommer i deras väg. Det håller i 17 år. Men när det spräcker, spräcker det ordentligt.
What changed for you when the CIA connection was public or became public?
Oh, everything. Everything. It was a ghastly experience. And I felt that it was that we were living in the banks of a volcano and would get this eternally. So many people defected, really, and it hurt. And you realized such years and years of effort, and it was destroyed. And Michael's reputation was destroyed, and Michael was suffered terribly, feeling for the good people that he'd recruited, really, to the Congress, and that now thought that he'd betrayed them. It was an awful period. It was an awful period.
Ifølge CIA's hjemmeside var Michael Josephson den perfekte mannen til å samle en broket gjeng kunstner og intellektuelle i kampen mot kommunismen. Han hadde ingen ordentlig utdannelse, men snakket 4 språk flytende. Engelsk, fransk, tysk och russisk. Han blev född i Estland i 1908, son av en judisk tømmerhandler. Men efter den russiska revolutionen flyttade familjen till Tyskland. Före andra världskriget jobbade han för ett stort amerikanskt varuhus i Berlin och steg raskt i graderna. Men i takt med nazisternas frammarsch blev han förflyttad först till Paris och senare till New York och Pittsburgh. Han blev amerikansk statsborger i 1942 och under och efter krigen jobbade han för den amerikanska armén i Berlin, bland annat som så kallad cultural officer. När hans ansättelse i Berlin gick ut i 1949 hade han av allt att döma svärt liten lust till att gå tillbaka till jobben som inköpschef av damaccessoarer. Omtrent samtidigt blev han, ifølge eget utsang, politiskt bevisst och formulerade idén till The Congress for Cultural Freedom som han blev direktör för i 1950. Det blev hans livsprojekt. I 1967 gick han av efter att Tom Braden, en av hans tidigare chefer vid CIA, hade publicerat en artikel där han bekräftade ryktena om att CIA låg bak organisationen och att Michael Josephson hela tiden hade varit deras man. Michael Josephson hade stora problem med att finna en ny jobb. Och i och med att han aldrig hade varit formellt ansatt vid CIA hade han inte rätt till någon pension. Han dödade i Genève 1978 i sviten efter en hjärtoperation.
I think the image of CIA is very different now than it must have been.
Yes. Oh, it was lovely then. Oh, gosh. But I feel bamboozled now. They were, from my point of view, my sight on them, idealist and realist. And not scared. They were all sorts of good things. Michael's problem when they disagreed, and that he fought them. And it wasn't a question of what these people in books say that he was a stooge from the CIA. He was an independent thinker and actor, and part of his problem was to keep the boss happy, and mostly he did that.
Låt oss tänka oss att detta är två skuespelare i ett historiskt drama. Arbetstitel: Den kalla krigen. De har ikke valgt hverken stykke eller rollene sine selv, men de spiller dem med innlevelse og overbevisning. En direktør innen kunst og kultur, og hans hengivne hustru. I de andre rollene ser vi kunstnere og intellektuelle av ulike nasjonaliteter og kaliber. Det som binder dem sammen er den felles fienden i øst. Han som befinner seg bak det såkalte jernteppet. Fienden opptrer aldrig personligt, men trusselen om att han ska komma och ta allting från dem ger historien nerve och mening. Och genom stora fälles ansträngelser lyckas det västliga lag att vinna terräng, och fienden blir mer och mer fjärn och ovedkommande. Då kommer avslöringen om att det västliga laget har juxet. De är inte fria och oavhängiga så som de alla publikum tror, men köpte och betalte av en viss etterretningstjeneste. Ett slags kaos uppstår, och ingen är längre helt säkra på vad slags stycke det är de egentligen spelar i, eller vem som egentligen är vem. Men för historien faller fullständigt från varandra tre direktören fram och erklärer att han alene har spelat teater, mens alla de andra har varit på ordentlig hela tiden. Bara han har latet som om han var något han inte var, medan de andra alltid har varit akkurat det de har föreställt. Fria tänkare, författare och konstnärer, utan någon bindning till CIA eller andra ekonomiska, sociala eller politiska intressen. På den måten behåller historien sin moral och det intellektuella sin trovärdighet. Men som Michael Josephson miste nästan allt.
Well, Michael had tea or something with Willy Brandt. There were photographers, of course, wherever Willy went. And Michael was busy doing this, searching this, and getting out of the picture every time.
He was good at this, to get out of the picture?
Yes, he was very good at that, among other things.
What was it? Was it because he didn't like to see his picture, like, or was it more like he didn't want to be sort of connected with situations too much?
No, it was because in this case that he didn't want Willy Brandt to be smeared by association with him if he were blown.
Hemligheten är att det inte finns någon hemlighet. Men att alla later som att det finns något viktigt att skjule och därmed avslöja. Michael Josephson later som att han är direktör för en organisation som driver med fri kunst och kultur. Diana Josephson later som att hon är gift med en sån man. Omgivelsen later som att de tror att bara Josephson är det de säger sig vara. Och paret på sin sida låter som att de tror att de andra tror dem. Så länge alla låter som omtrent det samma, fungerar allting bra, arbetet följs meningsfullt och givande. Helt till någon kommer från en helt annan historia och spör, varför akkurat disse människorna inte nämner Vietnamkrigen med ett eneste ord. De som har tidskrifter och böcker och pengar och författare och filosofer och trovärdighet. Är det någon speciell grund till att det låter som ingenting när det handlar om amerikanska intressen? Kan det vara CIA som betalar för allt sammen? Alla blir väldigt överraskade över att någon säger högt det alla allerede vet och förnekter det uppenbara in i det längsta. Till de må inse att de står där med skägg i postkassen, buksene nede, och lösbarten är på halv tolv. Utanför kan det se ganska komiskt ut. Men för dem som är vant att behandlas med respekt på grund av sina konstnärliga och intellektuella insatser är det en smärtefull och riskabel tillstånd. Resultatet blir att alla vänder sig mot Michael Josephson och låter som att han har fört en baklys i alla dessa år. Och han på sin sida låter som att det är akkurat det han har gjort.
I was just curious when you said that after your honeymoon he told you what he was up to. In what way do you tell such a thing? Because it's such a special thing.
Well, you tell it in a positive way. And I was very proud. And I realized what an important man he was. And that was nice. I think that there was a small thrill in doing something on secret and having us in this together.
Sannheten är att ingenting av detta hade skett hvis det inte hade varit för kommunisterna. Utan Stalin hade Michael Josephson sannsynligvis måttet vända tillbaka till damassessoarerna efter kriget. Och där man antagligen aldrig träffat Diana, som i det tillfället inte hade fått någon Fulbright-stipend för att resa till Europa. Utan ett järntäppe hade alla dessa människorna näppe kunnat mötas på kongresser och seminarer världen över, ge ut tidskrifter och böcker eller arrangera utställningar och festivaler för många miljoner dollar om året. Men hvis det virkelig var dem som reddet Europa fra kommunismen, var det ytterst få av dem som ville ha noen ære for det etterpå. Og hvis det virkelig var dem som åpnet europeerne sin for markedsøkonomi og nyliberalisme, var det ikke mange av dem som hadde lyst til å si noe om det ettertid. Kanskje har vi virkelig dem å takke for at New York ble sentrum for den moderne kunsten, og at 90% av alle kulturprodukter i Europa produsert i USA. Kanskje spilte de ingen rolle i det hele tatt. Men uansett om de gjorde fra eller til, betalte Michael Josephson en ganske høy pris. Og kanskje syntes han at det var verdt det.
I was going to say that all these people were having a very good time. Not just me, but it was thrilling fighting for something that you believed in, that you felt that you were making a difference in the world, that it wasn't, futile. And the effervescence of living in Paris, all this combined, and also the combination of interesting people that you were working with. This was wonderful, not just for me, but for everybody.
Middelhavsfarere, kaller man dem, som tar sjansen på en rask forandring av den egne livssituasjonen når anledningen byr seg. De har ikke de nødvendige ressursene, og må derfor ta seg noen friheter iblant. De vil ikke noe vondt. De vil leve godt og ha det bra. Gjerne sammen med likesinnede og for statlige penger hvis det mulig. De trives godt ved havet og i solen og med vaskehjelp og andre som gjør tilværelsen lettere. Gi dem ikke noe fysisk arbeid. Det passer dem ofte svært dårlig. De vet hvordan man oppfører seg under vekslende omstendigheter, og ikke sjelden veldig underholdende selskap. De vil ikke noe vondt. De vil bare ha det bra, men helst ikke sammen med Kreti og Pleti. Middelhavsfarere, kaller man dem, som tar sjansen på en rask forandring av den egne livssituasjonen, når anledningen byr seg. Det ikke deres feil at de ikke ble født med de nødvendige ressursene.
Microphone works, or for this doesn't matter. Okay. Wow. Okay. So I am Lene Berg, and I'm one of those many artists doing videos all over the world to be presented in the Pregnant building in Berlin. So this film, The Man in the Background, was made almost exactly 10 years ago. At the same time, I finished this publication, which is a related thing. It also deals with the Congress for Cultural Freedom and the CIA during the Cold War. I'm not going to talk very long. I'm going to present you very briefly to the publication and how it was built.